Hello, everyone. This is Focus 580. My name is Philip Graham. I'm standing in this morning for the irreplaceable David Inge. And I am a fiction writer and a professor of creative writing here at the University of Illinois. And it is my great, great pleasure to be able to introduce David Joss, who is a poet, a writer, a brilliant writer on the craft of fiction, and just about everything he puts his hands to, he's wonderful. Before I start, I'm going to go on a little bit, and I'm going to embarrass David to death talking about him. But first, I want to let everybody know that if you hear anything in this conversation that interests you and you want to put in your 2 cents or more, you can call us at 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. That number is 9455 in both of those are actually spelled out as W-I-L-L. Okay. David Joss is the author of 2 books of short stories, Crimes of Passion and Black Maps. That's the latter of the winner of the AWP Award for Short Fiction. He's appeared in the Best American Short Story Anthology, the O. Henry Awards Anthology, 2 Pushcart Prize anthologies. He's also an award-winning author of poetry, 2 books, Improvising Rivers and You Are Not Here. And his poems have appeared in the Paris Review, Poetry, Black Warrior Review, and Plowshares. His latest book, and why he's here, though we're going to be talking about the wide range of David's work, is what I think is going to be proven to be one of the definitive books on the craft of writing fiction. It is a brilliant book. It's called Alone with All That Could Happen, Rethinking Conventional Wisdom About the Craft of Writing Fiction. And it does just that. It's just been published by Writer's Digest Books. I should also say, he's slumping in the seat as I go on. He's a very modest fellow. David's also a distinguished editor, having served for several years as the editor of Crazy Horse. He's won many awards, including a James A. Michener Fellowship and an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship. He teaches at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and he's also the current director of the Vermont College of Fine Arts Low Residency MFA Program in Creative Writing, a program that recently was hailed by Atlantic Monthly Magazine as one of the 5 best programs in the country. So, welcome, David.
Welcome and thank you, Philip.
Have I embarrassed you enough?
Yes, you have.
Good, good. Okay, now, I haven't told you what I'm going to be asking you, and I don't think we have ever talked about this subject, but you are a great lover of music, particularly jazz, and you have written a lot about jazz, especially in your poetry. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the connections that you see between music and writing, and also what it's like to write about jazz, write about the music that you love. And I'd actually like to ask you to read one of your poems about that a little bit later, but
sure.
I'll sit back and relax and enjoy.
Well, one thing I would first hasten to point out is that I'm not a musician myself. Mm-hmm. I just merely envy them. I think musicians have a far larger alphabet than we can ever have, mm-hmm. A great emotional palette. They're able to express so much more than words can, and so I always envy them. And I've always been particularly drawn to jazz, which seems to me to be the most expressive form of music, although I love many other kinds of music as well. What I really admire about jazz musicians is how they essentially are composing at the same moment they're performing. Mm. This is something that I don't think any creative writer, at least any sane creative writer, would ever want to do, say, okay, I'm going to step on the stage and I'm going to invent a poem or a story for you, mm-hmm. before your very eyes. Yeah. It takes an incredible kind of skill and faith in themselves that I find really, really arresting.
Yeah.
And the musicians' lives are really what fascinate me. I've never written a story about a jazz musician, because I really don't know that much about the life, mm-hmm. but I have written a number of poems because I feel I can maybe fake it for the course of a moment in a person's life, and I have rather sneakily managed to choose as the moments I write about for my jazz musicians ones that are not on record.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
Ones that have not been filmed.
Nicely done.
So that no one can say, nope, it wasn't that way. I wrote a poem about Sun Ra, for example, in a performance in Germany, mm-hmm. and it was at a time that he did tour Germany and did play in this particular place, but it was not recorded.
Yeah.
And so I had carte blanche.
Yeah. Yeah. That idea of improvising, I'm thinking of the title of your first book of poetry, Improvising Rivers, was there that sense of that particular beauty of jazz's construction in your mind as you were writing that poem?
Yes, absolutely. And the poem is about something that I used to do a lot more than now, but I still do it. When I'm having trouble sleeping, I will imagine rivers. Hmm. And I'm really making them up. I love rivers. I grew up in a town in Minnesota that was built on the confluence of two rivers, the Minnesota and the Chippewa. And I spent a lot of time as a young person, you know, along the rivers. And so I found myself drawn to them, and it makes me peaceful to sort of create in my mind a river. And what I'm really doing is drawing bits and pieces from rivers I've seen so forth. And it seems to me that's kind of like what happens when a musician is playing.
Yeah.
And if you listen to the sounds of nature, you know, it's music.
Or the lack of music. You've written that the homage to John Cage as well, which is this famous 4 minute and some odd second piece.
33 seconds.
Yeah, called, which is just silence.
You know? Right. And the point of it is that, hey, the whole world's an auditorium.
That's true.
There's constantly sound, and we have to listen to them. And for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, we listen to that music rather than the music that he would perform on the piano.
And you've seen that performed, so to speak.
No, I haven't.
Oh, really?
I've seen a film of it.
Okay. I actually saw it at Alice Tully Hall once.
Oh, wow.
And into the third act, or the third movement, I got a little antsy.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to scat sing out loud in the audience. And people turned around and shushed me. And then people turned around and laughed at the people who were shushing me, because it was the whole point was, you know, you hear what you hear.
You know? Made a great contribution to it, though. So I'm sure that Cage loved it.
Maybe. I don't know. I couldn't help myself. You know what I would love if you could read? This is the very first poem of yours I ever read, and it's the very first poem of You Are Not Here. And it's Traps, about the Buddy Rich Band in the Avalon Ballroom in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1968. And you actually are... is this a fictional character or is this a memory that you have?
This is a combination of both. I don't think I've ever written anything that is 100% autobiographical.
Yeah.
I actually, in the poem, the speaker of the poem did not want to be there and was taken there by his parents. I actually went with a friend who was a jazz fanatic. He's the one who really got me interested in jazz. He was a drummer himself and he wanted to see Buddy Rich. And so this was something that I chose to do and wanted to do. But simply saying, hey, I went there and I saw this and I really loved it, there's not much drama in that. So I had kind of changed the situation to make the speaker someone who was reluctant to be there and gradually became trapped, in a sense, as the title suggests, by the music. So this is an actual event. And I found out only years later when I was reading... his biography, the biography by Art Pepper called Straight Life, that he was actually in the band that night. So my very first time that I listened to a jazz band, one of my favorite saxophonists was playing and I didn't even know who he was.
Oh, no.
Anyway, it's called Traps. Right off, I wanted to escape. Jazz was dark, smoky bars, chicks in sunglasses, dope deals in the John. Not this ballroom's glitz, grandmas and evening gowns, and traps the boy wonder grown old. This wasn't the hip scene I craved, just my parents' wet dream of pre-war innocence and fun. But then Buddy, whose name fit him the same way Tiny fits a sumo wrestler, swung his Mussolini glare on his long-haired bass player. The kid must have erred in some way my rock and roll ears couldn't hear. Yet it mattered so much it made Buddy glower, his hate white hot, the rest of the set. And I began to listen, ears pried open, caught.
I love that last line, too. Because for me, when I read that, I felt caught by that poem, and therefore there was no way I was not going to read the rest of the book.
Thank you. And that incident did, I mean, the last half of that poem was accurate. The speaker and his situation and his lack of interest in the jazz is invented. But that actually happened.
Yeah.
And in fact, a few weeks later, I saw Buddy Rich on The Tonight Show, and he talked about how he had to fire a bass player.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I'm pretty sure that this was the
guy. That was the guy.
This was the guy.
Probably because he didn't have the jazz chops. He was some long-haired guy, listened to rock and roll and so forth. And yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually once worked on a boat with a guy who was a jazz vibraphonist.
Teddy Charles.
And he hated rock and roll. I mean, he really, mm-hmm. he could go on a real bender about it because it had taken his livelihood away from him. You know?
Right. Yeah. And that was true of an awful lot of jazz musicians, yeah. although there were people like Miles Davis who embraced some of these things.
Yeah.
He listened to Sly and the Family Stone and said, hey, there's a direction jazz can go.
I made the mistake when I was working on that boat with Teddy Charles. He became a sea captain for a while of praising Bitches Brew in front of him, and he almost bit my head off. He just exploded.
Yeah,
I was a wrong. I thought I was going to say, see, I know jazz too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The thing also I like about that poem is that it is a story. It's a little story. And, mm-hmm. you know, you are such a wonderful fiction writer and poet. Sometimes you get a sense that someone's essentially a fiction writer but dabbles in poetry or vice versa or does mm-hmm. creative nonfiction. But
I just dabble in both.
No, you don't. But likes to do that sort of thing. Oh. Where here I feel as if everything you put your mind to becomes as – your important way of breathing as an artist, you know? Mm. And yet I feel also that there's – I'd like you to talk about maybe what you see the connection between the two genres, because I really admire how you can do both.
I think there are more similarities between poems and short stories than there are between short stories and novels.
Yeah.
I think the impulse toward compression, synecdoche, the whole idea of trying to tunnel down to the essence rather than create a whole world is, I think, very similar. And as you say, that poem does tell a little story.
Yeah.
Most of my poems do tell a little story.
Yeah.
I see story, and a story can be told in a moment.
Yeah.
One of the poems is about Ornette Coleman, and it really is about one moment playing one song in Morocco, and at the same time it's about all the moments of his life, the key developmental moments of his life coming to bear on that one moment. So I'm essentially telling a story of a whole life, but trying to do it in a moment.
Would you like to read that one out?
That's from
I think it's Improvising Rivers, right? Isn't that where
yes it is. It's called The Master Musicians of Jojuka. I think that's how it's pronounced. Ornette Coleman is Morocco, January 17th, 1973. The former jam jiver from Fort Worth who played Stardust at the white school's prom and later Uncle Tom the Blues for Shake Dancers in Silas Green's New Orleans minstrel show. And later still, a young Methodist Jesus, bearded, hair curled in a croaking knoll, thrown off bandstand after bandstand, and beaten once in Baton Rouge for playing strange. Mocked, too, in L.A. for his white plastic alto, the instrument Parker played at Massey Hall, the greatest concert ever. A toy to those who refused his request to sit in, just one song, please. And the elevator boy at Bullock's, pressing the emergency stop button to study Slonimsky. The divorced husband who wanted to be a man, not a male, and begged his doctor to castrate him. Even the composer of Freedom, they have disappeared. Someone else is here, recording at the festival Abu Jalud in the Muslim Lupercalia. Villagers dressed in white caftans coil and swirl, frenetic in the bonfire's light to the raitas and drums, the wooden flutes and gimbris of the family that since the 13th century served as court musicians to the sultans, while Bujalud, the wild man in black goatskins, sows panic, lashing out, baring red teeth. Every woman he whips with his switch will bear a child this year. Ornette's so far inside this music, this past that's more present than the present, he's lost his own past and the future it dreamed. Mm-hmm. So when a tribesman, frothing at the mouth, dashes howling past the horn mics, the Doppler affects a concise history of his or any life, its moral long arrival followed by longer loss. And he echoes it, his face now dark, now firelit, with his sax's harmelodic moan. He knows tomorrow he will have to return to New York, so he holds the howl as if it can never fade, as if he's free of time's gravity, free finally, and home. I should point out that that poem actually is about a moment in a recording. I realize that's one exception to the my general rule.
So you lied to us.
I did lie. Unintentionally, but I did.
This is wonderful. And it seems it really captures what you're talking about in terms of the improvising, you're composing on the spot, but it also that what's behind the improvising, what's behind the composing in that moment of time is decades, really, that gets poured into
a whole
it.
Life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, wouldn't you say that writers do that in the privacy of their own offices? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, when we're revising and so forth, we were doing the same kind of thing. We're improvising the story, the poem, whatever it is we're working on to make it real. We just don't have the pressure of an audience looking up, a physical audience, not an imaginary metaphorical audience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think in order to be a good improviser, you can't be thinking about all of the things that you're doing. A lot of it has to be unconscious work, and a good writer will get him or herself into that kind of a state. And not just, you know, for a first draft, but even during revisions, try to get into that state where you're really not sure where it's coming from, and only later can you figure out exactly why you chose this or that particular detail or event.
It's like you're surfing on the crest of the wave of your own past or something without really knowing
very
it.
Very nice way to put
whatever,
it.
I have so many things I want to get to. I want to talk about Black Maps, but I don't want to forget that here's a way to get to Black Maps, perhaps, is I love so much about this book and Black Maps. No, this I'm trying to actually get to the craft book. eventually, I will get there. But I love the craft book along with all that could happen. I found myself transformed in my understanding of the way you write about prose rhythm, point of view, epiphanies completely. Was an epiphanic moment for me in the way you deconstruct it and show all the different ways that you can have epiphanies. It doesn't have to be the thing that gets tagged at the end, which is what so many people think is what you're supposed to do.
Francine Prose calls that the cherry on top of the sundae.
The way you write about hills like white elephants, but we'll get to that. But I think the very first one, autobiographophobia, I've always stumbled on that.
Autobiographophobia.
And you start the book with two stories that maybe you could recreate here about getting two phone calls from fans. If you could either,
I'll summarize it quickly. These were two phone calls that came in fairly close succession. The first phone call was from a Vietnam vet. And he had read a story of mine called Freeze, which had appeared in the Pushcart Prize anthology. And he was calling to find out if we had ever met. He said I was that Lyckie at the same time that you're talking about here in the story. And I recognized, the lieutenant and a few other characters. And he asked me if I knew, I forget now what the names were, but I wrote them down at the time. He asked me if I knew certain people, and I said no. And I said, it's a work of fiction. I never was even in the military. And he was furious, absolutely furious, because someone had the gall to write a story about something that wasn't true. And he hung up long before I could try to defend myself. Not too long after that, I received another phone call about a story of mine called Rainier, which is about a divorced man, an alcoholic, whose son gets killed in a car accident, and he goes to his funeral and has to see his ex-wife and her new husband as part of the experience. Well, I got a phone call from a man from Arizona who said, I just want to tell you you're not alone. I've been through the same thing. My son was killed in a car accident. He was trying to tell me about the great value of AA and what it had done for him and so forth. And I did not have the heart to tell him that I was never divorced. I've been married now for 37 years to the same wonderful woman. I have, I'm not an alcoholic by any means. And my son is very much alive. These are things that I would hate, and I think to some extent we write stories in the same way that so-called primitive tribes people would create an effigy of themselves in of straw and set it on fire so they would now never die in fire. I think there's some of that kind of sympathetic magic going on in the writing of fiction. But I didn't have the heart to tell him this. But it got me thinking about, you know, why people will read a work of fiction and assume that it's telling the truth.
So I
wrote that essay kind of in dealing with it. And I have to admit that I play a little trick on the reader in it. I fess up to it in the notes, but I don't know how many people actually read the notes.
I have not read the notes, so please tell me.
The final section of that essay says, what better way to end an essay on autobiographophobia than with some autobiography? And then I tell a story about my youth. If you go to the notes, one of the notes says the so-called autobiographical section
is
fiction.
You stinker. I'm going to have to go back to the notes now. You have a wonderful list, and after you tell those stories in here, maybe I'll ring this off because maybe you say here, on paper I have been, or at least tried to be, a nun, a serial killer, a bag lady, a 9-year-old boy, a 99-year-old man, a woman afflicted with hysterical blindness, a teenager who witnesses his father's nervous breakdown, a man with an artificial hand, a divorcee, a girl from Bangladesh, a minor league baseball player from the Dominican Republic, a Hmong refugee, a 16th century Spanish priest, a 19th century Russian dwarf, the biblical Lazarus, and various other characters, including several actual jazz musicians and authors. That's quite a list. And, I mean, it's sort of – I love the stories of the two people calling you when you say, well, this wasn't true and that wasn't true. But then when you give that list of all the various people you have been and inhabited, and my realizing, yeah, I've read all those. I've read those in poems. I've read those in stories. And that still – the list impressed me enormously in how much alternate lives we hold inside ourselves that I guess writing lets out. And I can't say that probably at the beginning of your career you decided, well, I'm going to be all these people.
No, I certainly didn't. I had no idea what I was doing and still to a large extent don't. But I've always been curious about other people's lives, and I've always lamented the fact that I only have one. One can only be in one place at one time, and you know, there's all these other possibilities that are excluded. It seems to me only in writing and in reading are we able to live more than one life at a time. And I'm curious about people. I had a grandmother who used to say about everyone she saw, "There but for the grace of God go I." Now, my grandmother was exactly the sort of person that people would have said that about herself, but it always made me wonder, you know, what if I were that person in that situation? And that's usually what triggers a story. I firmly believe that this is not an evasion of myself or my beliefs or whatever, but a way actually to discover them. As Oscar Wilde said, give a man a mask and he will tell the truth. We know this from sociological tests. If you know, kids wearing ski masks at recess will behave differently than if they're not wearing a mask.
It seems to me when all those different people that you write about and you talk about it in terms of empathy, you know, it seems that that's really also a prescription for like a successful life in the social world outside of art, right? I mean, if you can't have empathy for the people around you, if you aren't curious about their motivations, trying to figure out when someone does something inexplicable or upsetting or whatever, why are they doing this? You know, whether it's a colleague or a friend or family, whatever it is, you're never, I think, going to have deep, lasting relationships. And so in a weird sort of way, we say art is kind of prepares people indirectly for meeting those challenges in life.
One of the biggest lies about literature and pursuing it as a career mm-hmm. is that it's impractical.
Yeah.
Nothing is more practical. You practice what you learn and by writing and reading every minute of your day, every minute of your life.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that most of the bad things that are done by people, to people, come from a failure of imagination, the inability to imagine what another person's experience is like. And there's no better way to begin to imagine that than to try to write your own way into someone else's life and to read literature written by the people of another country.
Yeah.
I grew up, as many people did, during the time of the Cold War, and our hatred for Russians was sort of almost, a requirement for mm-hmm. considering yourself an American. And I've started reading Russian literature. And wait a minute, why should I hate these people?
Yeah.
You know, they seem an awful lot like me.
Yeah.
You know? I think really that if people were familiar with the literature of people from around the world, it would be a lot harder for us to demonize them, simplify them into something they're not.
Something we say we would need to do with Middle Eastern authors.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's a wonderful website, I don't know if you know this, called Words Without Borders.
I do not know.
It's a monthly web magazine, and every month they have a new edition. And they have writing in translation English from writers all over the world, and there's some stunning, stunning work there.
That's great.
You know? I should take just 1 minute to tell people we are here and waiting for calls or would like to receive calls if you would like to call us. If you want to talk to Dave, the phone number is 333-9455, WILL, and 800-222-9455, again, WILL, those last four numbers. You're being so nice. I said, will you read this? Will you read that?
Yeah,
and you
sure.
just do it, you know?
Sure.
But I love the poem Lazarus.
I
absolutely love the poem. That poem stunned me when I first read it, and I've read it over and over again. And it's, again, a sense of the empathy that you have here. You know, I mean, people say write what you know, which is a terrible thing, and maybe we could talk about that sometime.
Sure.
Too. But, you know, how can you know what it's like to be risen from the dead, and mm-hmm. I think you do an incredible job of that, and in a way that's completely unexpected and beautiful.
Oh, thank you. About the write what you know, I mean, I think that's mm-hmm. the single worst advice you can give anybody who wants to be a fiction writer.
Yeah.
It's not bad for a nonfiction writer, but for a fiction writer, I love Grace Paley's formulation. She says, you write from what you know mm-hmm. into what you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, if you're not doing that, you're not really writing fiction. You're writing kind of a glorified nonfiction.
Yeah.
Well, I've always been fascinated with the other parts of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that old radio bit that Paul Harvey used to do, the other side of the story?
Yeah, yeah.
I hope this doesn't sound like Paul Harvey.
No, it doesn't.
But it's, I always wonder, well, what happened to Lazarus afterward? You know, how do people treat someone who's come back from the dead?
Yeah.
And here's the poem. After the miracle, my sisters could not bear to watch me eat, and when I spoke, which was rare, they turned away from my ruined mouth as if it were the cave where I had lain 4 days. Before Jesus called my name and I arose, swaddled in grave clothes, my jaw strapped shut with a knotted cloth, and eyes blinking fiercely in the blast of light. I was no god like him who has since risen to his heavenly home, nor still a man, for I had died. My sister Mary washed our Lord's feet and dried them with her hair, but the odor of the tomb still clung to me like a second skin, so she let dirt blacken my feet to my scabby ankles, and my nails grow thick and horny as a lizard's claws. And though Martha burned bowls of resin and scattered fragrant spices throughout our house, still they could not bear to go near their dear brother. How I wished they would ask the question that made them eye my blue-black skin, the bleeding sores that mottled my face. How often the question rose to their lips, where it became, aren't you hungry? Won't you eat some more? Or you've grown so thin, don't you need another blanket to keep you warm? I ache to tell them how it felt to witness your own disappearance, the betrayal, one by one, of the senses that comprise you, the swirl of snow that rising drops you, numb, a stone, into a well so deep no one can hear the echo of your long fall. But words failed me, or I failed them, and I raged in silence till the day Mary passed me on her way to market, and her eyes shifted from mine as from a stranger's. With an animal howl, I took her wrist and pulled her protesting down an alleyway where the poor had heaped their garbage. This is what the dead eat, I said, and plunged my fist into a rotted melon, writhing white with maggots, and ate until the pulp soaked my beard and streaked the dirt caked on my robe. Let me go, she pleaded, but I held on until I'd sucked the last juice from my fingers. Then I dropped her wrist and waited for her to run away, as the children who called me names would do when they saw me coming down their street. But she just stood there, holding herself, as if suddenly cold, and looked at me, my festering mouth, my weeping eye, then threw her arms around me and cried, O Lazarus, in a voice that pierced my stone ear like a shaft of light. I woke then from a sleep so deep and hollow I had not known it was sleep, and stood there, blinking. My hand rose to Mary's hair and famished, stroked it, my fingers trembling. Then I held her dear head against my chest so she could hear my heart beating there, divinely human in its grave of bone, before I let her, my sister, my savior, go.
Wow. I should mention, by the way, to people out there that David Joss will be reading at the Illini Union Bookstore today at 4:30. I love that poem. Now, I have to get to the craft book. Okay. I'm keeping a look at all the things I want to say. I know I don't have time for it. But so many of these essays in here really altered the way I look at writing fiction. I mean, in a good craft book, I often, if I'm looking at it, I think, oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot about that. That's good to remember and so forth. But mm-hmm. in your book, I thought, holy, I really? And, or I should have known that, but I didn't. And I think maybe the one that blasted me the most, though, I'm not going for first, second, or third place here, mm-hmm. is when you discuss Hills Like White Elephants by Ernest Hemingway. Now, I've already mm-hmm. always taught that story as a form of Hemingway putting the reader in the position of being somebody at a table next door to this couple who are mm-hmm. talking about an abortion without wanting to be overheard, that sure. that's what they're talking about. So
That's how it starts, for sure.
Yeah, and you're put in the position of being an eavesdropper, and that's why there's no access to thought and so forth, because any eavesdropper can only get what the people who are speaking, and not to them, mm-hmm. are saying to each other, and often it's in code. But you do something that completely transforms my understanding of that story, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, there are a few little steps in the story where Hemingway stops using what we would call the dramatic point of view, which simply presents what the people say and do, and lets us see what they're looking at through their eyes. Like she'll say that the man looked down the railroad tracks and
yes.
saw X.
Okay.
Just a very slight little movement into point of view. But then at the very end, there's this one little quick second when the man goes into a bar and he orders a drink.
Yeah.
And he looks around and we get the line that all the other people were waiting reasonably for the train.
Mm.
That tells us that he thinks the woman he's been with has been unreasonable.
Mm.
We, on the other hand, have been seeing him as kind of a Machiavellian villain trying to manipulate her into doing what he wants, which is to have the abortion, and
mm-hmm.
also to take responsibility for that decision,
mm-hmm.
without by absolving himself.
Yes,
which would have made this kind of a little melodrama in
mm-hmm.
some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But because we now see that he actually thinks he's being reasonable,
yeah.
we have a deluded human being,
mm-hmm.
and the possibility of melodrama fades, and the story becomes more complicated.
Yeah, yeah, and yet it's not. It's Hemingway jumping in. right? And so I think when you, that's the thing that people often talk about, point of view is something that's completely connected to character. And you're saying, well, no. And you come up with a number of examples. This is just one of them in which the author manipulates point of view, sometimes contradicting what seems to be the point of view of the story up to that point to dig deeper into the material. And that's not bad. That's something that's available to you as an author.
Basically, first of all, I'm kind of a skeptical person. When someone tells me that something is such and such a way, my mind immediately looks for examples that contradict it.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of my thinking.
Yeah.
And I've always been very frustrated by creative writing textbooks and their comments about point of view, because at first, when I first started thinking about it, I thought they're just trying to make this a lot easier than it really is, or simpler, just, you know, on a basic level. But you could go to any creative writing textbook, and the higher and higher you go, it's still the same inaccurate portrait of what writers actually do. My goal has not been to prescribe, you know, how one handles point of view, which I think most textbooks kind of do. But to describe it, and for example, in that essay, I take one paragraph from Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and show how he segues from an omniscient statement to a point of view that is reflecting the thoughts of the character, to indirect interior monologue, and direct interior monologue, and then finally back to the dramatic point of view. There are four points of view in one short paragraph. And if you don't do that, if you don't manipulate how far in and out you are of the character, that's the equivalent of having a movie camera that never moves position.
Let me just remind everybody, we're talking to David Joss. I should spell your last name, because it doesn't look like it. I mean, it's J-A-U-S-S. Right. I used to always call you Joss until I met you.
Well, I answered to all of those.
Okay. Some things you don't want to answer to. But David Joss, who's a wonderful poet and fiction writer, and he's here to talk to us mainly, though it hasn't really turned out that way, to with his craft book, Alone with All That Could Happen, Rethinking Conventional Wisdom About the Craft of Fiction Writing, David Joss. You do the same thing with epiphanies. Now, again, and I love what you're saying here about not wanting to be prescriptive, and so many books are. Every time you do a book, they say, well, here's what you do when you get to the end, and here's the revelation, blah, 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 blah. And you basically say, what a boring, predictable thing to do. And in fact, you find, simply by being an excellent reader of fiction and poetry as well, here's a story where the epiphany is in the first page. Here's one where it's in the center of the story, and it's what leads to, and then goes from, and so forth. That there's no law that says one must wait until the last page before the epiphany can arrive. And it just it's of course that it's completely reasonable, you know, absolutely. And yet you get locked into sometimes as a writer thinking, well, this is the way it's done, forgetting that there's no way it's done, and that's the beauty of your book.
Alice Munro, who just in terms of her prose, people might think of as a traditional writer, is actually extraordinarily experimental in kind of the same manner that Chekhov was. She has one story called Miles City, Montana, in which the main character is a child at the beginning and has the beginning of her epiphany as a very young girl. And it isn't completed until she's a grown-up and married and has a daughter. So, you know, instead of the idea of the epiphany as being something that just bursts upon us conveniently at a point where the author wants to explain his theme, we see it as a lifetime process. So lots and lots of different ways to handle it. And one of the things I try to do in the essay is give a number of examples of well-handled epiphanies.
I think beautifully done. I also, maybe you were talking about, you know, you thinking in terms of contradictions as part of your personality, and the last essay, Lever of Transcendence, which is such an extraordinary essay, is about combining contradiction. And if you could maybe talk a little bit about it, maybe starting with the exercise that you do with your students.
I do this with my introductory students, and it always provokes an interesting discussion. I tell them that I'm going to teach them all the basics of the creative process in about 30 seconds. Of course, it takes a couple hours to explain what that 30 seconds actually what happened in that time. I asked them, first of all, to write their name on a piece of paper, and of course they assume this is just so that I know who wrote them. And then I asked them to answer the same question, to write down their name, but this time to make up an alias. And they do, and I actually time them. It usually takes only about 10, 12 seconds longer for them to come up with a lie than it does with the truth. Mm. When I ask them to write their actual name, I'm asking them to use a form of thinking called convergent thinking, where the assumption is there is one correct answer and an infinite number of incorrect ones. And we use this, you know, all the time, and thank goodness we do, because if we went up to a red light and asked ourselves, I wonder what that red light means, by the time we consider all the other possible meanings, we could be in an accident.
Yeah.
The other mode of thought is called divergent thinking, and its assumption is that there is only one incorrect answer, which is your actual name, and an infinite number of possible answers. And what I usually demonstrate to my students is that they try, very naturally, they stay very close to what the fact is. And sometimes they're not even aware of why they chose the name that they did. One student, for example, her name was, and she gave me permission to use to refer to this in the essay if I wanted to, so I assume she won't mind if I repeat it.
Yeah.
Her name was Kay McDonald, and as her lie, she came up with Kay Karen Farmer. So if the first name begins with the same letter.
Yeah.
And she turned McDonald into Farmer.
Oh, yeah.
And she did not know why.
Oh.
It was a totally unconscious thing. So my point is to show how we have to diverge farther and farther away from fact. Because if the first thing that we think of is the most familiar thing, for example, if you write the words flat as A, most people are going to think, you know, pancake.
Pancake's coming up.
All right. And if you write that in a story, you've created a cliche, and it's weakened your work. And same thing happens on the level of characterization. You know, you got a character with a fiery temper. Okay, red hair. If you do that, you end up writing poorly. So the goal really is to, in the creative process, to destroy that first thought, that convergent thought, the familiar thing, and consider other possibilities.
Yeah. There's a beautiful story in Black Maps called Brutality. I had a conversation that a couple is having. I think they're coming home from a dinner party, is it?
Right.
Yeah, and the husband has revealed before his wife that he used to hunt, and she's a vegetarian and against the killing of animals, and she's deeply upset, in a sense, because he's created a contradiction for her. She loves this man, but he's done something that that she finds hard to forgive, and it takes place in a very short period of time. It goes, the conversation continues home, it continues in the bed, and it's a beautiful, for me, story about two people learning more about each other, but the difficulty of doing that.
Right. I find myself more and more drawn as I get older to stories that are about what appear to be fairly small moments, and yet are inherently packed with drama.
Yeah,
I mean, an entire relationship can depend upon this small conversation about a past, about who he was in the past.
You get a sense that they're really walking a razor's edge, you know, to use a cliche. Sorry, but that there's trouble.
Thought.
Yeah, I know. There's trouble there. You know what I'm saying? That this things could go bad if this doesn't get negotiated properly. You know, and so there, it's actually one of the most dramatic stories in the collection, even though nothing overtly dramatic happens.
Right. This is this led me to want to read Milan Kundera's
quote,
which is an epigraph to Black Maps. And it kind of explains why I like those kinds of stories that are about those small moments that may not seem to be dramatic, and yet they're crucial. This is from his book, Book of Laughter and Forgetting. It takes so little, so infinitely little, for a person to cross the border beyond which everything loses meaning. Love, convictions, faith, history, human life, and herein lies its secret, takes place in the immediate proximity of that border, even in direct contact with it. It is not miles away, but a fraction of an inch.
Yeah. And that's an epigraph that really rings through all of these stories. I haven't asked you to read any of the fiction from this book, but maybe if you could do the paragraph in Frieze, that's at the last paragraph of 24, page 24, that goes to the end, to the break there, with those two paragraphs. Frieze is about a guy who is, he stepped on a landmine in Vietnam. This is the story that got you in trouble with the guy in the phone call. Right, yeah.
Right.
And he doesn't blow up. The rest of the story is almost like his afterlife. He's unable to handle the fact that he's not dead.
Right.
And in this case, he's just stolen, because he's really trying to get himself in a lot of trouble. He's just stolen, I think, a commanding officer's steak, and he's off in a corner and he's cooking it.
Okay. Where do you want
smelling
to
the steak?
Okay.
And to the end of the break.
Okay. Smelling the steak browning on the plate, he forgot the stench of the burning shit for the first time that day. He leaned back on one elbow, lit a park lane, and inhaled deeply, holding the smoke in his lungs. As he smoked, he looked out over the brush at the lead-colored sky and tried to daydream about going back to the world. He imagined he was back in Little Rock, lying on a lounge chair beside his apartment pool, catching some rays and checking out the talent. But the daydream began to unravel as soon as it started. First, he couldn't remember what his pool had looked like. Then he wasn't even sure whether he'd had a pool at Cromwell Court or if that was earlier at the Cantrell Apartments. And the girls that strolled by in their bikinis were faceless, vague. He tried to remember Mary Ellen, the girl he dated the fall before he enlisted, but nothing would come to him. He wasn't sure of the color of her eyes or hair, the sound of her voice. He laughed. Then he listened to himself laugh. It was such a strange sound. He wondered why he'd never noticed how strange it was. He tried to remember Mary Ellen's laugh, but it was no use. Ever since he'd come to Nam, he'd been forgetting things, and now almost everything was gone. And what he did remember seemed more like something he'd overheard in a bar, some dim, muffled conversation. He couldn't have seen Perkins holding his plastic yellow guts, or CB's brains in his mouth, the top of his skull turned to pulp. He couldn't have seen these things. It was impossible. Wasn't Perkins transferred to another company? Hadn't CB gone back to the world? By the time Frieze finally remembered to turn over the steak, it had burned black.
Yeah. Such a great section. We have a little bit more time, and I'm going to turn this in a little bit of a left turn here. You mentioned Grace Paley earlier. She was a mentor of mine when I was an undergraduate, and I loved her very much. And she taught her students not only how to be writers, but how to be people who were writers. Mm-hmm. And Grace was very, very politically active. She was engaged in the world, and she really, by example, not by exhortation, made it clear that a full life is a life that's engaged with what you most passionately believe in. And you've been involved for a long time with what the West Memphis Three, and maybe you would like to talk a little bit about that.
I would very much like to talk about that, but let me preface it by saying that I absolutely adored Grace Paley and everything that she stood for.
Yeah.
What I said earlier about most of our social ills being caused by lack of imagination, I think she realized and lived out by devoting herself to trying to improve the world, and she was just a great role model.
Yeah.
In 1993, 3 8-year-old boys were horribly murdered in West Memphis, Arkansas. And with three young men were convicted for the crime, despite the fact that there was no physical evidence tying them to the case, and despite the fact that the confession of one of them, who was a boy with an IQ of 70, which is the equivalent of a third-grade child. Mm. That's really essentially what they used to convict them. Mm. This confession is shot full of errors, basically repeats the rumors that were going around at the time, and the physical evidence contradicts all of them.
Mm.
No DNA evidence of any of the three convicts was ever found, although they did find tied into the shoestrings that were used to tie up these boys, the hair of one of the boys' stepfathers, and the fact that it's inside the knot strongly implies that that person was present at that moment. Despite the fact that there was no evidence and that they had this extremely flawed confession, the confession, for example, would say the boys were killed at 9 in the morning and that they had skipped school. In fact, the boys were in school all day and the murders took place at night. He said the boys were sodomized and forced to perform oral sex. Physical evidence disproves both of those claims. Mm-hmm. He said one boy was strangled with a big stick. None of the boys was strangled. He said they were beaten bloody with their clothes on. Their clothes were found with no blood. Oh. Step by step by step. A forensic linguist named Dr. Martin Hill has examined the confession and concluded that all of the substantive information was supplied to this boy by the police in the course of their questions.
Yeah.
And that his responses, the things that he offered himself, were either incorrect or contradictory.
Yeah.
Okay. So despite all of this, for 15 years, a group of people have been fighting this. There's an organization called Arkansas Take Action, and I urge people to go to their website, www.freewestmemphis3.org, and you can either spell out .org or either spell out the three or use the numeral, and it'll get you there, and you'll find out more information about this case.
Great. Thank you. This is David Joss we've been speaking with. He's here in town to give a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore today at 4:30. He's the author of his most recent book of Alone with All That Could Happen, Rethinking Conventional Wisdom About the Craft of Fiction Writing. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.